You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research out of UW-Milwaukee digs into one of the state's lowest income zip codes and why the 53206 area of Milwaukee has so little economic opportunity. We'll talk to the study's author. First, Door County leaders are figuring out what to do about the area's public transportation system known as door-to-door rides. On average, door-to-door provides nearly 43,000 rides a year all over the county, and it's said to be the fastest-growing public transportation system in the state. But officials say it's not financially sustainable to keep running as it is. The situation has users worried that the program will be greatly reduced or even outright eliminated. But it's also possible it could be largely saved. Joe Krebsbach is the Door County Human Services Director and the de facto head of door-to-door rides. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
You're welcome. Glad to get a chance to talk with you.
Now, when people think of public transportation, they might think of something in a bigger city with, you know, big buses and fixed routes. Can you tell us what this system in Door County has looked like for the past couple of years?
Our system is something called a shared ride taxi system. So it is kind of a rural community or a small community's alternative to the bus system. And so we have taxi services provided by a contracted vendor, and those services pick individuals up, again, door to door. Our name implies what we do, but we pick people up at their home and drop them off at their destination. It provides a little bit higher level of service because sometimes it even assists people with moving groceries and that kind of stuff, so getting them to the doorstep of their home or residency.
And what do we know about who is using this system as far as age or people with disabilities? What do you know about the usership?
Well, the majority of our riders are identified as either having a physical or some level of disability, or they're over the age of 60. So about 72% of riders fall into one of those two categories. And then another 7% are students.
And I know you've heard at public meetings and elsewhere from users. What do they say about how the door-to-door service helps them get around, helps them keep their lifestyle up?
Well, I think it certainly provides them a level of independence and a feeling of autonomy. They can get places without having to rely on friends or family members. So there's a level of independence that it provides people, and they certainly are appreciative of being able to have that mode of transportation when they can't drive themselves.
Now, you're the Human Services Director there in Door County. That's a job title that doesn't usually include Director of Transportation Services. Is this a little bit, cobbled together over the years?
Yeah, I would say it is. I meet with a lot of the Human Services Directors around the state. I'm not sure anybody else is running transportation as well. It kind of fit in. We run some transportation, ADRC bus. And so that's kind of how it all started back in 2010, was that it was added on or tied on to the service we used to run out of our senior center or the senior center bus. So that's kind of how it all started.
And I understand now you're looking at the system and wondering how you're going to pay for it into the future. Can you talk about the finances behind the door-to-door transportation service?
Yeah, the finances are coming from a few different places. We have a couple of different state allocations or grants that we run, and there's some numbers tied to those. Probably don't mean a lot to people, but those require some county match or some county levy that's put in. So we get some state funding, and we get county tax levy funding that's put in, and then we get farebox funding. And those three things are a match to the federal funding that comes in for the public transit piece itself, the door-to-door system. And over the years, those things have changed or adjusted based on how our system is working. And where we've kind of gotten to is a couple of things. Number one, our system is so large that for it to stay with me under Human Services is just not practical. We're not really giving it the attention that it needs. And then additionally, so one of the things we need to do is bring in management. But in addition to that, some of the fiscal pieces have changed over time to the point where the county needs to now invest significantly more tax levy than we have in the past. And so that's where kind of the issue at hand is we're going to need to make some decisions about whether or not we're going to continue to provide that service, which requires us to come up with those additional funds.
Talking to Joe Krebsbach, Door County Human Services Director, about public transportation in Door County. His department runs, in effect, the door-to-door ride service in Door County. So what are some of the options, Joe? It sounds like there's a wide range from canceling the service completely, downsizing it. What kind of range of options are you considering?
Right now, we've put three options out for the board to take a look at and provide us some feedback. And again, you covered those. One is to eliminate the program altogether, and that would leave only our ADRC bus available in Door County.
And that's for people with disabilities, ADRC,
yep.
Is that right?
Correct. Aging and Disability Resource Center, sorry. And that particular program is also where our meals program and some of the other stuff for seniors is. So I would say the majority of people who are riding that service are over the age of 60. So one of the options would be to end the door-to-door system itself. The other option would be to provide that system at a much reduced rate. We can do that, again, based on how all of those fundings match. If we decrease revenues or increase revenues, that decreases the amount or increases the amount of federal dollars we get. So we could cut the service down to about 45% of what we're currently offering financially without additional burden on the county. That obviously would greatly reduce a system that's already having trouble keeping up with the capacity demands that we have. And then the other option would be to run the service as it currently is, and that will cost the county approximately $170,000 for next year. And then with some projections up through 2014, closer to $215,000. And that would be an annual cost of tax levy that would have to be appropriated towards transportation. And ultimately, with the tax levy freeze, that would have to come out of other program areas.
And Joe, I've talked to people in other non-urban counties and even people at the national level. You are not alone in Door County in trying to deal with these issues. When you talk to your colleagues in other counties, are you hearing similar concerns from them about, hey, how do we provide mobility to make this a livable county for a lot of our citizens?
Yeah, I think this is happening all over the place. And certainly, I mean, these types of programs are being run in other counties. And I think part of the problem is probably twofold. Federal dollars, the percentage of funding that we get is decreasing. And as the state runs more and more programs, the money that comes into the state of Wisconsin is getting dispersed to those other programs as well. So we are, transportation is struggling, I think, in pretty much all areas.
Do you think that without some kind of service like this, there's going to be a population that currently lives in Door County that we'll find they can't make a go of it? They can't get to the grocery store, the doctor's appointment, what have you?
I'm not sure how they're going to make a go of it if we would eliminate the services. Those services weren't provided before 2010, and people were getting around somehow, but certainly less conveniently and less freedom of movement for them. And again, I think, you know, we know that the biggest use of our resources to get people to the doctors and the grocery stores. So those are our three highest users, the two of our grocery stores and the doctor's place. Those are the most popular drop-offs and pickups.
So, Joe, what is the timeline now on a decision for door-to-door?
Well, over the next 2 months, we're going to have to make some decisions. We're currently at the end of a contract. When I say currently, 2019 is the end of our contract with our vendor. When we bid out, if we bid out a new system, that would have to be done probably by this summer. And we have to know how many hours we're going to bid out if we're going to try and get a vendor to come in and provide this level of service or whatever level of service we have. So I would say by June at the latest, the county's going to have to make a decision about it.
We'll leave it there for now. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Joe Krebsbach is the Door County Human Services Director. We talked to him about the uncertain future of the county's public transportation system known as door-to-door rides. Coming up, we'll talk about the effects of what a new report calls concentrated disadvantage in one Milwaukee zip code. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Attorney General William Barr testified in front of lawmakers this week about his handling of the Mueller report and what information he plans to release. We'll find out what he had to say during our look at the week in Washington. First, Wisconsin's unemployment rate has been at or below 3% for months now, but in the 53206 zip code in Milwaukee, the economic picture tells a very different story. The zip code is on the city's north side, west of I-43, and in a new study, UW-Milwaukee's Center for Economic Development took a closer look at what's described as concentrated disadvantage in the area. Mark Levine is Professor Emeritus of History, Economic Development, and Urban Studies at UW-Milwaukee. He's also the director of UWM's Center for Economic Development and author of their latest report, 53206 Milwaukee, The Anatomy of Concentrated Disadvantage in an Inner City Neighborhood. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. It's really good to be with you.
Well, paint us a picture of the economic outlook there in the 53206 zip code.
Well, the economic outlook in 53206, I think it's fair to say, remains fairly bleak. Poverty rates are high. Joblessness is pervasive. Incomes are plunging and have continued to fall even since the end of the recession. And 53206 is certainly a place where mass incarceration has had quite a significant effect. So a lot of the issues of disadvantage in inner city areas that are talked about across the country in many cities are really present in 53206 to an extraordinary degree. Now, it's fair to say, though, that on some of these indicators, there has been some improvement since the end of the Great Recession. And so I think, there needs to be some balancing act here in looking at the situation. The employment rate, for example, for males, prime age males between the ages of 25 and 54 in 53206 climbed from about 36%, an incredibly low number, to 47%, which is still an abysmal number, but it's better than 36% over the last decade or so. So there are some indicators that are, I think, improving slightly, but I think the bottom line, certainly in the study that we've just come out with, is that there's a long, long, long way to go in 53206.
Even when people are employed, income seems to be a problem. Do I have this right? I saw a chart. A college-educated resident of this zip code in Milwaukee, 53206, makes about as much as a high school-educated worker in Waukesha County?
I think one of the striking findings, that's absolutely right, is the degree to which incomes are low, so we have working poverty. There's a lot of underemployment in 53206. So it isn't just that, the jobless rate is obviously very high. We've got, half of prime age workers, both male and female, not working in 53206. But even among those who are working, about 20% have incomes that put them below the poverty line. Even 10% of those working full-time, full year in 53206 have poverty-level income. So we've got, sort of that problem. But, as you alluded to, one of the things that I think we found quite astonishing was the degree to which education doesn't sort of level the playing field in terms of the labor market for residents of 53206. Now, we know from a vast amount of economic research that there is an educational premium. The higher your education level, the more you're going to earn compared to someone with less education. So, and that holds in 53206. A college graduate in 53206 makes over twice as much as a high school dropout. The employment rate for a high school for a high school dropout is 3 times higher than it is for is 3 times lower, I should say, than it is for a college graduate. But what we found astonishing was the degree to which, when you look across different areas of Milwaukee, a college graduate in 53206 earns about the same as a high school dropout in Waukesha County, a suburban area west of the city. And so that tells you there's something going on here beyond simply the educational credentials of workers, and it's something that sociologists call place matters, that there's an ecosystem of disadvantage built into 53206, whether it's because of a spatial mismatch, that the jobs in Milwaukee are not particularly accessible. The jobs that are growing in Milwaukee are not accessible to residents in 53206 because of transportation connections or what have you, or because of entrenched racial discrimination in certain sectors of the economy. I think we'd have to dig down a little more deeply to get at that factor, but it is astonishing that education doesn't seem to totally level the playing field at all.
Let's talk more about that spatial mismatch you just mentioned. There are people in this zip code of Milwaukee who need jobs. There is job growth often in areas not that far in the scope of things from there, but we can't get one to the other. Why is that?
We've done some studies at the center beyond simply this study that demonstrate the degree to which transportation is a fundamental obstacle in the Milwaukee labor market, that the transportation links between inner city areas like 53206 and the somewhat more dynamic job growth centers, mainly in Waukesha County, but also to some extent in the outer reaches of the Milwaukee County suburbs and in Ozaukee County, just aren't that strong. Bus transportation is sporadic. We've had bus lines, for example, that are supposed to link workers to jobs in these growing centers that have been cut. And, of course, we don't have a regional rail system to get people to those jobs. There's been a long-standing opposition to any kind of light rail system on a regional basis in Milwaukee. And so all of that impedes the ability of workers in central city neighborhoods like 53206 to get to jobs. Then when we look at the persistence of, what clearly needs to be called racial discrimination or racial preferences in labor markets, there are all sorts of studies demonstrating the degree to which those factors still operate, and to the disadvantage, obviously, of primarily African American inner city workers. And then, when you add on to that the fact that with the crisis of mass incarceration, you've got a fair number of workers in places like, or potential workers in places like 53206, who have a criminal record recently, or ex-incarcerated individuals, and that factors against those workers in getting into the labor market, no matter where the jobs are. So you've got, as we point out, sort of cumulative disadvantages that impede economic opportunity in this zip code.
Talking to Mark Levine, professor and director of UW-Milwaukee's Center for Economic Development, about the economic challenges facing the 53206 zip code in Milwaukee. Mark, it seems like the dream would be to have job creation in the zip code, or maybe right next door, accessible jobs for the people who live in this neighborhood. What are the obstacles to that happening?
I think there are several obstacles. One is simply the preference still of many employers for suburban locations, preferences because of proximity to highways, preferences because of, in some cases, still lower land prices, although that's changing, obviously, in distressed neighborhoods, and then concerns about issues of crime in central city neighborhoods, the costs, presumably, of moving their firm from a suburban location. There are incentives or disincentives, I guess, to invest in central city neighborhoods. So there's kind of a structure of investment that works against neighborhoods like 53206. And I think mostly because of the cumulative and kind of interlocking nature of a lot of these disadvantages that we describe in the paper, it poses sort of a seemingly insurmountable set of obstacles for businesses to locate in and around the neighborhood, in and around the zip code. And so you really do need, and we don't go into major policy options in the paper, but I think certainly one of the policy issues here is that you need something like a big bang, a Marshall Plan kind of investment in neighborhoods like 53206, because the problems are so entrenched or so ingrained that we need sort of major investments to provide incentives for business growth, public employment for workers in the zip code, and ways to raise incomes in the zip code, which will of course then create incentives for businesses to locate there because there's more consumer demand potentially for some of their products.
You mentioned there has been improvement in this zip code in Milwaukee, the 53206 zip code, since the Great Recession. Are there bright spots that you see, reasons for hope based on that improvement?
I think there are. I mean, I do think that what we do see is, to a limited extent, and I've certainly argued this for many years, that while it's probably not accurate to say a rising tide raises all boats, it's clear that a rising tide, meaning high economic growth and a tight labor market, does ultimately, as you get deeper and deeper into an economic growth cycle, have an effect on even the most distressed of neighborhoods. And so growth matters. You know, we saw this, for example, in the reduction of minority joblessness in a place like Boston in the 1980s and the 1990s, when that distressed city really turned around and those growth rates really began to improve the economic opportunities for in some of the more distressed neighborhoods in the city. And I think we're seeing some of that in Milwaukee. I think, you know, clearly the jump in the employment rate for African American prime age males in 53206 is encouraging in that regard. Looked at some recent data that shows that for black males as a whole in Milwaukee, in Metro Milwaukee, the employment rate has actually jumped for the first time in a generation, really, over the last 5 or 6 years. So I think we can see the benefits of tightening the labor market and achieving high growth. The problem is we can also see the limits of that, that it's not enough, that we need to do it more rapidly, and we need to deal with some of these structural impediments like the transportation issue, like the racial discrimination issue, and the like, before we can really make significant progress in poor neighborhoods like 53206.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Mark Levine, director of UW-Milwaukee's Center for Economic Development. He was with us to talk about the center's latest report, looking at the effects of a lack of economic opportunity in Milwaukee's 53206 zip code. For information about how transportation factors into this story, you can find more reporting from our partners at WisContext. Check out their story at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll check in on some of the top stories from the nation's capital, including the Attorney General's comments today about the Mueller report and the related FBI investigation. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a late winter storm has already started to affect parts of Wisconsin. We'll talk to a meteorologist with the National Weather Service about what we can expect. First, we take a look at some of the big stories in national politics this week. Attorney General William Barr has been testifying in front of lawmakers about his handling of the Mueller report. Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen's departure adds to the list of departments being led by acting cabinet members. And some 2020 presidential candidates are weighing in on the prospect of expanding the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Our question for you this week, would you support that idea, expanding the court in the future? Do you think it would do anything to make partisan battles over the court less intense or less common? Should it be left as it is with the magic number 9? And does it matter to you what a presidential candidate has to say about the idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ginger Gibson is a correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with Attorney General Barr today. He reopened questions about the origins of the Mueller probe and whether FBI surveillance of Trump campaign members was legal. Here he is answering a question from Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen about whether he thinks the FBI spied on the Trump campaign.
I don't. I guess you could. I think there's spying did occur. Yes, I think spying did occur.
Well, let me.
The question is whether it was adequately predicated. And I'm not suggesting it wasn't adequately predicated, but I'd need to explore that.
So this is something that President Trump has maintained happened for a long time. Did this add something new to the conversation, Ginger?
It did. I think a lot of people sort of did a double take or a double listen when they heard that today, hearing the Attorney General say that the government spied on a presidential candidate. Using the word spy, I think, is pretty evocative of a lot of people's attention. So did bring something new. President Trump, as you may recall, accused the Obama administration, in fact, President Obama himself, of having wiretapped Trump Tower. So this has been an ongoing sort of conversation. And we do know that the government, the FBI, did obtain warrants to listen to some Trump advisors who they were concerned had been compromised by foreign influences. So we knew that already. But using the word spying, particularly by the Attorney General, I think it's kind of a very attention-grabbing phrase today from Barr.
Another big question, as Barr testifies before a couple different congressional committees, actually, is when will Congress see the Mueller report, and what will they see exactly? What has the Attorney General indicated about when and how redacted this will be?
You're right, he has been in front of several committees. We have to sort of also note that he's there to talk about the Department of Justice's budget, which is not the Mueller report, but he's fielded quite a number of questions on the Mueller report. He has said that they will not, he doesn't intend to give Congress an unredacted report, saying yesterday, "I don't intend at this stage to send the full unredacted report to the committee." In response to a question, he has sort of gone a little about how much he could give and who could give it. He also sort of suggested that if the chairs of the Senate and House Judiciary Committee wanted to see the full report, he would be open to discussing with just those two the ability to read it. In the past, we know that some information that members of Congress have wanted, instead of being able to get a copy or to let their staff read it, the chairman or the chairwoman of a particular committee are allowed to maybe see that classified information. So he sort of allowed that as a possibility. But it seems to be, he's sticking to his earlier points that Congress as a whole, or even just members of some of the key committees, will not be able to see a full unredacted report, which is the demand that those committees have been making.
Now, we'd heard reporting, and this is at secondhand, but that the Mueller team wasn't happy with the Attorney General's four-page summary of the report, and that they had written summaries of their own that, didn't include any classified information or secret grand jury testimony. And they're wondering why that summary, again, if it exists, wasn't released. Is that a question that's been coming up for the Attorney General before Congress?
Yeah, you know, we've seen members of Congress asking about why they can't get access to those pieces, especially in the wake of reporting that Mueller and his team, aware that not everything maybe should or could become public, that there would be classified information, that there would be sort of methods, the way that they obtain that information is often not included in that grand jury testimony is secret, that they prepared sort of paragraphs or pages of information that could be released, and that the Attorney General has opted not to do so. To be clear, Attorney General Barr had been very clear, even during before he was the Attorney General, during his confirmation proceedings, that he intended to write his own report to Congress. He was not going to turn over the report. But those are the kind of things that sort of raise a specter of what is in the version that Mueller and his team put together, that they intended for public dissemination, or at least congressional dissemination, that is not in the information that Barr has released. That's the kind of thing that reporters start wondering if someone wants to hand it over without, any names attached, that we could get a copy, since they did prepare something like that that they thought was fine for public consumption.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. Ginger, Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen resigned on Sunday, and that makes it, we've talked about that some already, but that makes her position the latest with an interim or acting secretary. Now, on my list here, I'm seeing acting heads of Defense, Interior, Office of Management, Budget, Small Business Administration, UN Ambassador, and Chief of Staff. This is kind of unusual, right?
It's very unusual. The president has sort of ended up in a universe where many of his top chiefs in his cabinet are not confirmed by the Senate. He suggested earlier this year that it gave him more flexibility to have acting, but that's why the government has a system set up where the Senate approves people so that presidents can't just put whoever they want in. There is this advising consent where they have to go to the Senate. So there's a good deal of criticism for that, but you're right. He's got this growing number of acting secretaries. There is some question about whether or not it's the Senate that's just taking too long, but they are controlled by Republicans. They need very little Democratic support to move these people. It's just become an arduous process and a controversial process, which slows everything down. When you've got so much controversy in your administration, every one of these hearings and every one of these processes can become quite fraught.
We're seeing more people now leaving their posts in Homeland Security. This just adds to the perception and reality of a lot of turnover in the Trump administration at top levels and at kind of that secondary level. Is there any sign of this settling down anytime soon?
There is not yet a sign of this settling down. We have been watching this unfold for a long time. We know that last year, in the late summer and early fall, ahead of the midterm elections, Republicans in Congress were really pressing the president to slow down on the turnover, that he needed to keep his staff, because all of the turnover, they thought, created this feeling of chaos and instability, and they were worried that voters were going to take that instability and vote against Republicans. Then there was, after the election was over, sort of again a big swing of turnover. So we're seeing that continue now. It's yet to be seen if maybe when we get a little closer to 2020, some of the president's allies prevail upon him again to sort of dial back that turnover rate, to try to keep people in jobs, to create a sense that there is stability in this administration ahead of his reelection. That may be hard, particularly because the president thinks that when he is firing people or getting rid of people or sort of running people out of his administration, that his voters see that as clearing out the swamp or clearing out the mess and respond positively. So might be something he likes going forward.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson, correspondent at Reuters, about some of the top political news of the week. In just a minute, we'll look at how the prospect of expanding the U.S. Supreme Court, adding more justices than the current nine, is popping up in the Democratic primary field. You can weigh in on that idea at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea of adding more justices? It would be a way for, if Democrats were to take power as president and in the Senate, a way for them to swing the court in a more liberal direction. That raises the opportunity for Republicans to do the same. What do you think of this idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. And is this something you want a presidential candidate talking about? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Ginger Gibson, correspondent at Reuters, looking at some of the week's news in national politics. Ginger, we mentioned this idea. Some Democratic presidential candidates warm to this idea of increasing the size of the U.S. Supreme Court. What's going on?
That's right. There has been, we have to sort of go back in time and remember sort of the fight we've been having as a country over the Supreme Court for about the last 3 years. You might remember Antonin Scalia dies right before the 2016 election. Republicans campaign heavily on electing President Trump in order to install conservatives. But in the meanwhile, President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the court, and Republicans in the Senate refused to give him even a hearing in the Senate, and therefore he never got confirmed. President Trump wins. He then nominates Gorsuch, who is seated, and then fast forward, and Kennedy retires, and we have Brett Kavanaugh. So now there are some liberal activists, a handful of them, who say the Constitution doesn't say how many Supreme Court justices there should be. There are nine, but maybe there should be 11 or 13 or 15 or however many we want, and that if a Democrat were to be elected president, instead of waiting for maybe a conservative or a Democrat to leave the conservative or a liberal to leave the court, they should just be replaced. They should not be replaced. Congress add extra justices to the court. Now, President Trump has said he's not going to do that, going the other way and add some extra conservatives. And we have seen even some Democrats pushing back against this idea. Bernie Sanders was asked about it last week in a forum, and he said he didn't think that was a good idea. If you add two liberal justices, once a Democrat gets elected, that the next time a Republican gets elected, they might just add two more. He thought that that was maybe not the right idea. But there has been some reception. We've seen some Democratic candidates say they would be open to considering proposals, that they would welcome ideas. We saw South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg say that he would be open to some proposals, although he thinks that maybe you could expand the court to, say, 15, but institute some requirements where you had to have near equal numbers of conservatives and liberal justices. So this is something that Democrats are signaling in some cases some openness to. But it's also, and I think this is part of the fascinating nature of elections, it's something Republicans want to talk about. They saw in 2016 that the court was an issue that really galvanized their voters and turned people out, and sort of telling your voters, like, be afraid if a Democrat gets elected, you may lose this court, which you felt was so important to hold on to, that they may encourage some people that might have otherwise felt not so excited about voting for Donald Trump more inclined to show up and vote for him.
Let's bring on a caller on this now. Sue is with us in Fish Creek. Sue, hi.
Hi, how are you? There was an idea put forth on NPR months ago that I thought was brilliant, and I can't remember the gentleman who presented it, but he said, suggested that they go to 18-year term limits, and every third year, one of the Supreme Court would be going off. I'm not sure how it actually gets started, but this is where I remember it. Every 3 years, a Supreme Court justice would be going off, and whoever's in presidency at that time would be the person that puts people forth, and therefore it would kind of over time level out that whole field. You wouldn't have to have more places. On Foreign Service, more places mean people that have pensions, that are there's more salary there, and the other way just makes sense.
Sue, thanks for the call. And we hear, and I've talked to people who advocated for roughly that plan on the show in the past, Ginger, is the idea of some kind of reform to lifetime appointments something that people are buzzing about in Washington at all?
It's not quite a buzz status, but there is a growing openness to it. We heard last week Senator Elizabeth Warren in a forum also asked about this, indicated that she might be willing to, as well, Bernie Sanders, support a proposal that would rotate judges, where they would go from the Supreme Court to the appeals court, so it wasn't these individual one justice for a lifetime on the court. Term limits is another one, maybe adding people who have been on the court, but shouldn't have to be there for their whole lives. They're able to sort of dictate policy for decades or dictate legal policy for decades. So that is another proposal. I think that we're a long way away from this. We have to remember this has only been suggested once. It didn't get anywhere in Congress. Washington is very reluctant to break from longstanding tradition. It would be a real hard fight to get any of this changed, even something like term limits or rotating judges or any type of qualifier separate from what we already have.
Thanks for that call, Sue. We're talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters about some of the week's top stories in national politics. Turning to another congressional oversight issue, Ginger, Congress and the president's tax returns, Democrats in the House trying to get them. White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney was asked on Fox News this week about the possibility of the returns being released. Here's a listen.
You believe Democrats will never see the president's tax returns?
Oh, no, never. Nor should they. Keep in mind that that's an issue that was already litigated during the election. Voters knew the president could have given his tax returns. They knew that he didn't, and they elected him anyway.
That's not exactly litigated, of course. That's a legal term. And President Trump has been saying he couldn't release his returns because he was under audit. That's not true. But members of Congress say, hey, we have a law on our side. We can requisition these tax returns from the Treasury Department, and they're supposed to give them to us. What's the status of that back and forth?
So right now they have not successfully obtained them, and it's a long way before they are likely to be able to do so. But they're going to keep trying. This has been a real rallying cry for Democrats. They think that the president should make public his tax returns. And we have to remember, he broke with decades of precedent of previous presidential candidates and presidents who have released these documents for public inspection. You're right. They point to a law that says that the House Ways and Means Committee can just ask for anyone's. They could ask for mine. They could ask for yours if they were doing some type of investigation, and that they are entitled to see the president's. This will be a legal battle. President Trump is also happy to be having this fight with Democrats. He thinks his base is galvanized when he's fighting with Democrats. He thinks that when he is viewed as being unfairly under attack, that his voters are sympathetic and that they will be more inclined to work harder for him to get reelected. I can't say one way or another whether we ever get them, but I can promise you that we're going to be talking about this fight for a good time now in the future.
Brianna Caller, Anne is with us in Green Bay. Anne, hello.
Hello. Well, I think he should have to release his income tax forms or his last several years because I don't know if it was the guest on your show, whoever just made that comment about he was elected because even though he didn't show his tax returns well, the point of the matter is he was not elected by the popular vote. So people seem to keep forgetting that. But yes, he should bring his forms forward.
And thanks for the call. And one argument Democrats are making, Ginger, is people need to know if the president has foreign-related investments that could influence him on issues.
That's right. That's one of the arguments that gets used to say that he should be releasing these documents. The other is whether he's profiting from his time in the White House. The president is prohibited by the Constitution for receiving anything of value for doing his job. And for that reason, there is a concern among his critics or vocalized, they say they're concerned, that he's making some money off of the White House out of his role as president. And they think that his tax returns would make clear whether or not that was happening.
And finally, Ginger, the House decided not to vote yesterday on a budget measure involving spending caps after Speaker Nancy Pelosi got pushback from a couple places within her caucus. Where was the resistance coming from?
You know, this is like everything changes and then everything stays the same. We are watching Democrats have fights over the budget, and she was getting it from both sides of her caucus, both progressives and moderates, who felt that their voices had been left out of the budgetary process. It's important to remember that budgets, congressional budgets, don't carry a lot of weight. They don't have the force of law. They aren't bound by them. They're really messaging documents. They're just a list of priorities. Budgets are not particularly followed at a federal level. It is another process called the appropriations process. So this is just a list of ideas, and they felt like their ideas hadn't been included, and they wanted new, different ideas. So pulled that vote for that reason.
Somewhere, I got to think John Boehner is smiling to himself because he ran into this, and then Paul Ryan, as Republican speakers of the House, where two different factions within their own party would shoot down legislation they were working toward. And now it's the Democrats' turn.
Absolutely. I think probably John Boehner is getting a little kick out of this since he went through this same process. It's sort of seen as like an internal fumble. Your budget doesn't have to get Republican approval, so it should be really easy to get your whole team on board with just passing it. But I think that maybe one takeaway Congress should take is that the budget system might be broken if we now see Republicans and Democrats failing to get it to work. It might be time to rethink that whole process.
And briefly, Ginger, some people are seeing this as the progressive wing of the Democratic Party flexing their muscles, trying to be an equivalent role to the House Freedom Caucus on the Republican side.
It is. It is going to draw a lot of comparisons. They're not quite the same. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party is not so ideologically different from their party as the Freedom Caucus is from the Republican Party, but providing headaches for their leadership just the same.
Ginger, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, correspondent for Reuters. She was with us to talk about some of the week's top stories in national politics. You can still let us know about what you think about the idea we were talking about earlier of expanding the U.S. Supreme Court to more than its current number of 9 justices, as some Democratic activists are talking about. Some Democratic presidential candidates say they like the idea, others don't. Do you think it would help make the court and debates about it less partisan, or would it just add fuel to the fire? Do you care what presidential candidates have to say about that issue? Is that something you'd vote on? Let us know. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org and share your thoughts, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think. Coming up in a couple minutes, we'll talk to a meteorologist about our April snowstorm. But now here's some advice on how not to deal with weather-related problems this time of year. School sports are already in high gear for the spring season. Soccer, track, I've seen some baseball and softball out there. And when the weather gets like this, it can cause problems for the players and the game. Here's a lesson in the wrong way to handle a wet playing field. The town of Ridgefield, Connecticut posted on Facebook this weekend, I will quote at some length, "There's been an incident in town that we want to make citizens aware of. A RHS baseball game at Governor Park was delayed due to weather conditions on the field this morning. A poor decision was made, and being looked into by the police department, to dry the field quicker, and 24 gallons of gasoline was poured and set on fire." Skipping ahead, "No one was injured and no one is in danger. The plan is to excavate the infield, place dirt in a safe container, and add fresh, clean soil to the field. We'll update you as we know more." So there's a moral to this story. No matter how much you want the game to go on, to get that field dry fast, do not pour 24 gallons of gasoline on it and set it on fire. Some life lessons from us here at Central Time to you. This is the Ideas Network.